It's boring to go alone, so take this podcast from Radio 1 91 FM.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m., our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews, and culture pieces from across Aotearoa Dunedin.
Kia ora, everybody. Welcome to R1 News at 1. I'm Jonah. We've got a pretty packed show today. We have interviews with the Honourable Rachel Brooking, and we've got an interview with Juju Moharam, who is the co-president of Amnesty Youth Otago. We've also got the bulletin and my film segment. So we will be back very shortly with the bulletin, but first up we've got Tohora by Aro.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin. Ko te rapare tēnei rā, te kauma iwa, o hepitema, mahuru. It is Wednesday, 18th of September. Ko Jonah Takamingua. In national news, new detailed climate projections from NIWA show that New Zealand is to get hotter at a faster rate than previously expected. RNZ reports. NIWA Chief Scientist for Climate, Atmosphere and Hazards, Andrew Tate, not that one, said that it was very important that communities use the new projections to prepare for the future. If countries were slow to reduce greenhouse gases, If New Zealand was slow to reduce greenhouse gases, New Zealand would be 3 degrees hotter by the end of the 21st century than it is today. Even if global emissions were reduced rapidly, the country would still be 0.8 degrees hotter in the same time frame. Current temperatures are, on average, already 1.1 degrees hotter than at the beginning of the 20th century. The data was found when NIWA climate modellers used a supercomputer to run the most up-to-date global climate models based on the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Tate also noted that the new data indicated that the country's average rainfall is slightly lower than previous models indicated. The general pattern, however, is consistent with previous models, which show wetter conditions on the west coast and south of the South Island, and drier conditions throughout the rest of the country. Unfortunately, these overall drier conditions do not mean that the risk of flooding is reduced. Tate said that the biggest impacts of climate that we have in New Zealand are heavy rainfall and flooding, which communities must prepare for. The Minister of the Environment has released the data to the public on their website. The Ministry has said that the councils, iwi, and businesses will be able to use the data to plan and prepare for the impact of climate change. Winston Peters has claimed that Parliament's standards are in a, quote, state of decay, Jamie Ensor of the New Zealand Herald reports. New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters has made scathing claims that Parliament is in a state of decay as he took issue with what he believes has been a sharp decline in standards. Peters, alongside his colleague Shane Jones, were displeased with a speech made by Te Pāti Māori MP Takuta Ferris. They were irked by Ferris's use of a laptop while giving his general debate remarks, and then he allegedly alluded that some MPs in the House are, quote, masters of lying. Ferris's speech led to many fiery remarks from MPs, with Speaker of the House Jerry Brownlee at some point stepping in and saying that Ferris was not keeping of the tikanga of the House. Ferris criticised the direction that the government was taking towards stewarding New Zealand, specifically taking issue with its approach towards constitutional matters. Ferris stated, "It is clear to see that there is a significant knowledge and capacity gap in this government when it comes to issues of a constitutional nature." He also further added, quote, "This House seems allergic to constitutional discussion or debate, unless, of course, they are defining the terms and engagement themselves with no regard to history or evidence." Unquote. Ferris's main critique, which Peters took major offence to, was when he stated that the knowledge gap, quote, "allows lies to be presented as truths. Politicians call this obfuscation. The art of making something unclear, intentionally vague, ambiguous, to conceal or obscure the truth, to confuse others. Lie, in other words. Many in this House are masters of it, and it is a disservice to those who voted to you and your positions." Peters did not take kindly to this, as he called a point of order, but it was not accepted by the Speaker. After much back and forth for MPs from all sides of the House, Peters ended the argument with a speech calling out a drop in parliamentary standards. Quote, "What we have got here is people walking in, T-shirts, sneakers, bare feet, lack of respect of the House, lack of respect for the country, and utter contempt. I have seen this parliament in such a state of decay. I wasn't here at the beginning of it, but I've been here for quite a bit of time. I have never seen it in such a bad state." Unquote. While Peters' speech was mostly directed towards Ferris, he was also referencing interjections from Labour's Helen White and a question that had been asked by Greens co-leader Chloe Swarbrick. In international news, 14 people have been killed and 300 injured across Lebanon as handheld radios used by the armed group Hezbollah have exploded across the country. Reuters reports. This comes a day after similar explosions were launched using the group's pagers. Tuesday's explosions killed 12 people, including 2 children, and nearly 3,000 were injured, the Lebanese health ministry reported. A Reuters reporter in Beirut's southern suburbs said that he saw Hezbollah fighters, quote, frantically tossing away the batteries of their walkie-talkies. Israel's military has declined to comment on the blasts. A senior Lebanese security source told Reuters that Israel's spy agency, Mossad, was responsible for planting explosives inside the pages. The operations have further stoked Hezbollah's tensions with Israel. The two have been engaging in an almost daily exchange of rocket fire since the Gaza conflict began last October. Hezbollah has vowed to retaliate against Israel for the explosion. Mohanad Haj Ali of the Carnegie Middle East Center said that, quote, "Hezbollah wants to avoid an all-out war. It still wants to avoid one. But given the scale, the impact on families, on civilians, there will be pressure for a stronger response." One Hezbollah official said that this week's detonations was the group's, quote, "biggest security breach in its history." Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, accused Israel of dangerously escalating the war on many fronts, pushing the Middle East to the brink of a regional war. Several sources informed Reuters that the plot seemed to have been the product of many months' work. They followed a series of recent assassinations of Hezbollah and Hamas leaders. In local news, Health Minister Dr. Shane Retty has caused confusion over his comments about the Dunedin Hospital being a phased build. The Otago Daily Times reports. The Health Minister recently stated that the new Dunedin Hospital... The Health Minister recently stated that the new Dunedin Hospital remains under, quote, active construction, but he is refusing to confirm whether the project will be a phased build or not. On Tuesday night, Dr. Shane Retty told Parliament that their proposed solution to the cost overruns of the hospital was to have a staggered build. Quote, "Instead of having one great big vertical build coming up out of the ground and you can cut the ribbon on day one and it all happens, it would be a waterfall design methodology, if you like. Building in phases so we can get people into new parts of the buildings quicker while we then move on to building other parts of the overall project." This quote from the health minister caused mass confusion from the media and the public, as he was alluding that the Dunedin Hospital could be turned into a staggered project, a possibility that had never been previously mentioned to the public. When the Otago Daily Times approached Retty to clarify his comments, he backtracked and said that his comments were made in reference to the context of the health sector generally. The previous speaker has first commented on Dunedin and then on difficulties surrounding the hospital builds more broadly. Retty further stated that the Dunedin project still remains under active consideration, as the government is working to deliver the hospital in a way that gets the best value for money. When he was questioned about whether or not he could commit to the Dunedin Hospital project proceeding as planned without switching to a staggered approach, he declined to answer. Dunedin MP Rachel Brooking has come out against Retty's comments in Parliament about the Dunedin Hospital project. She tweeted that his comments were, quote, "exceptionally concerning and sound like there will be a very major change / cut made with a modular build now on the table." Brooking will join us at 1:35 to talk about this topic and her concerns about what this could mean for Dunedin. This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday, 19th of September. Today's bulletin was written by Jonah Broughton and Charlie Cunningham and read to you by Jonah Broughton.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Kia ora. Today we're joined by Juju Moharam, a law and politics student here at the university, who is the co-president of Amnesty Youth Otago, or AYO. She joins us today to chat about some of the mahi that AYO is doing. Kia ora, Juju, thanks so much for coming and joining us.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
All good. So I guess I'll just start off by asking, could you please tell us a bit about Amnesty International's general strategy and specific focus here in Aotearoa?
Yeah, so Amnesty, Amnesty operates in so many different countries. But I guess in Aotearoa it's got quite a unique position because it's focusing on doing like a lot of work in like gender and racial justice, but also like climate justice and like the stuff that you get from the international strategy. But then we've also got like kind of Aotearoa specific goals, like everything that we do has to uphold Te Tiriti and has to like you know, have those like honour Māori tikanga and that kind of thing in the practices that happen. It's also got a focus on the Pacific, so obviously we're in a unique position. We have communities in the Pacific that you can do outreach for through New Zealand, which is quite unique. But Strategy 2030 is mostly focused on refugee and migrant justice, climate justice, gender and racial justice, and rangatahi, and our right to health. So those are kind of the areas that Amnesty works in. And then it just has like values of being like anti-racist and like uplifting collective voices. But that's like the special thing about working with Aotearoa Amnesty is that you get everything global, you get everything local, and then you have to think about it as in like that co-governance idea as well.
Mm. Yeah, perfect. And could you please tell us a bit more about AEO and how AEO came into being and what you guys do in campus and the wider community?
Yeah, so I was quite involved with Amnesty at high school, and then I came to university, and to my dismay, the Amnesty group at university had sort of like fallen out of activity and stuff. So I thought about getting it up and running again. So that was sort of happening in semester one. And then we honestly just started in May. Like, that's when we became OUSA affiliated. And it's, again, like, echoing that statement of, like, the New Zealand Amnesty in general, is that we work, so we talk about all the campaigns that Amnesty International is doing. Like, on our social media, we have a petition every week on a different issue, and, like, we try and raise awareness about that kind of stuff. But also, we have our own community outreach things that we do. So we recently ran a workshop at Otago Girls, and that was just for leadership purposes. So we do a lot of that stuff where we just get, like, involved in the community. We go to protests as a group, that kind of thing, just to get involved and have a community-based approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we've already started to touch on this, but being here in Otipoti, we can often feel quite removed from the world at large, and obviously Amnesty is all about human rights in various places, some of them very far away. How do you personally feel that we can make meaningful actions to honouring human rights in places far away from us?
Yeah, so I think about this in a couple ways. Firstly, there's like a big idea in Amnesty in general of about like civil society and getting like people together in a way that like strengthens the community, because it's like a core belief that that's how you pressure governments and businesses. So I think that like in Dunedin, there's quite the like a strong point that is the university. So we're quite well equipped to be like to have a global citizen approach to, you know, local events and settings, but also like global issues and stuff. So like we have international students here and like international groups on campus that connect us very well to different issues happening around the world. And then on the flip side of that, you actually have the Amnesty group here in North Dunedin, which is really active and does things like individuals at risk programs. So it's literally just a story of someone around the globe that you take on and you learn about and you educate the community on. So I guess there's that sort of side of thinking about it, but also the fact that like even though we are quite small and like you definitely feel that not just through Amnesty work but like through any work within your organization, we're a hub for everything rural around us, but we're also really well set up to like do things through social media and stuff. And honestly, it's like the small places, like if you are somebody and like there was a recent thing that was run for Russia and Ukraine, like the Freedom Challenge and stuff. If you're doing Freedom Challenge and you're submitting work from a small place like Otipoti, like you're getting that message out that like no matter where you are, you can still get involved, which is honestly just so important if you're trying to have that like mindset of you're not just living in a world where you're not impacted by everything happening globally, because you are. Like, that's the whole point of being a global citizen. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the world is a very interconnected place, especially the academic world as well.
Yeah.
So could you tell us about any work that AO is planning in the future that you're particularly excited to get involved with?
Yeah, so we've had a couple of events where we've just gone together as a group and like just had some fun, like a quiz night and stuff. And that's obviously so fun, like just to get together with people and like work on advocacy or letter writing and stuff. But I think what I'm most excited about is something that we're planning for next semester, like just sort of mid-sem one. And it's a student advocacy exhibition. So we're quite passionate about getting as many students involved in like politics and human rights as possible, but we also recognise that that needs to be like quite diverse. Like if you write an essay, that's great, but if you've written a song or if you've painted something, that's obviously like just as important. So we're planning this exhibition that anyone in any field who's like done any creative work for politics or human rights can submit work, and we're just going to display it and like have a bit of a like a mix and mingle for people to enjoy the work and learn something about an issue.
When can we expect that to happen?
Probably like right before the mid-semester next semester, so like I'd say like late March, that kind of stuff.
Perfect. Well, looking forward to it. Well, thanks so much, Juju, for joining us. I think it was a really good chat, and if you're listening, definitely get amongst it, get involved. Cheers. Thank you. Okay, next up we've got Hotoa Warrior by Jazz Common.
Welcome back to the R1 News at 1. You just heard Duncan Duke with Crusher, and we are about to be joined by the Honourable Rachel Brooking. She is the MP for Dunedin for Labour, is the spokesperson for them for the environment, food safety and space, and Dunedin is her home for a very, very long time. Earlier in the news show, during our bulletin, we recapped Dr. Shane Retty's comments that he'd made towards the Dunedin Hospital rebuild about, you know, his allusion to Dunedin Hospital rebuild becoming a modular build, and then backtracking on those comments with the ODT. So we welcome Rachel now to talk all about that and respond to his comments. Welcome, Rachel. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me. I'm very well, thank you. Beaming in from Wellington. It's a sitting week.
Thank you. Yeah, we're very, very grateful to have you on the show today. So yes, as I said, on Tuesday night in Parliament, Dr. Shane Retty did say in the House, and it's like kind of unclear right now whether it was a comment he, you know, made haphazardly or whether he was following on a comment he had been making about the Nelson Hospital, about the Dunedin Hospital moving to a modular build, which means it would open in stages rather than all at once, as we had been expecting. But then later on, you know, the ODT reached out to him and asked him to clarify, and he backtracked on that comment. But at the same time, when they asked him to commit to whether the Dunedin Hospital project would proceed as planned, he declined to comment further. As a member of Parliament, how concerning are Dr. Retty's comments? How does this appear to you?
Yeah, really concerning. I was in the House when he made them, and he was talking about Dunedin specifically. And if you read the Hansard, he says that in reference to Dunedin. And he was talking about perhaps not being a vertical build and it being phased. So it's important for listeners, if you're driving along the one way, you'll see that there's a big hospital building opposite the fire station that's gone up. And that is the outpatients building, and people can see the cladding's going up on it, and it's, you know, much closer to completion. Then across the road, there's the inpatients building. And this is the sort of the bigger of the buildings and the more complex one, because it has the surgical theatres in it and things like that. And if you're driving past, if you look in the gaps between the fence, or if you're walking or cycling past, I don't want to put everyone in a car, or you're in a bus, then you'll see that there's these big piles coming out of the ground. And that is the building that we're talking about, and that is the building that there's been quite a lot of political fuss about for some time now. So when we were in government, we'd got to the stage in April last year where the minister, who was then Dr. Aisha Verrill, she said there'll be no more changes to the planning. We're getting on with the building now. And that was in April 2023. Since the election, almost a year ago, the government has been very quiet on where exactly the rebuild is at. And this is despite them saying that they were going to do more than what Labor was going to do at election time. So I wasn't surprised in the House to hear the minister and his backtrack that we've had, but it's very concerning that he's not being clear about what they are intending to do. They've put in a new commissioner, being Lester Levy, and he's basically saying everything's on the table, we're reconsidering everything. So it's just no good for Dunedin to have this uncertainty, and they must be clear with us about what's going on.
How important, like, is this commitment as well? Like, how soon do we need to see that? And what are members of the public and, you know, the health people involved in the healthcare sector here telling you? Like, when do they want to see that?
Well, you know, in November last year when the government changed is when they expected to see the commitments. And so, as I said, it's been almost a year and we still haven't seen it. So he really does need to come to Dunedin and say what is still under consideration and what is not, because those big piles are sticking out of the ground and it takes years to obtain all the property and then the consents to do that building, let alone make all the decisions before you get to that place. So all of that has been done and now it's just a total hold-up. And of course, this new hospital, this inpatients building, is important for Dunedin and the wider region because it's the tertiary hospital where more complicated work can be done with people in need. And also, of course, it's a teaching hospital as well, which is so important to the university.
Mayor Jules Radich and other Dunedin City Councillors have launched a campaign called Hospital Cuts Hurt in response to the government's refusal to commit to the plan for Dunedin Hospital. What are your thoughts on this campaign, and do you think it will impact the government's thinking process regarding this build?
Yeah, it's great that the council is campaigning. They were campaigning before, and certainly as then a backbench MP, we were very much made sure that any ministers knew about the campaign and how important the Dunedin Hospital was to Dunedin, and of course it's Labor that's really been pushing ahead with it. So good that the council has reignited that campaign, and of course for the reasons I just outlined is so important. And I think, you know, the mayor needs to be very clear in asking the minister to explicitly say where things are at with this hospital build and what is under consideration and what is not under consideration, and of course demand that the build as promised by Labor before the election and as, you know, even National promised more, will happen without further delays. It's crazy that they've just squandered this past year.
We have it's kind of in the works, I'm sure you're also aware of it, a march planned by the DCC about to be announced, kind of finalising the details around that. How do you plan to also support this current movement? Will you be making it to those marches? What are you going to be doing as our MP for Dunedin?
Yeah, very much hope to support any things like that march. Also, our spokesperson for health infrastructure is Tracy McAllen, and so we ask written questions and we ask questions. So we ask written questions to the minister about what's happening, but also where those comments came from on Tuesday night was because it was the estimates debate in Parliament. So that's a continuation of the budget debate, and so my colleagues Ingrid Leary and Tracy McAllen, both on the Health Select Committee, and they were asking questions to the minister about where things were at with with the rebuild of the build of the new Dunedin Hospital, and that's what led to his comments talking about a phased and modular design and a waterfall approach, which of course, going back to my initial comments, we've got these big piles coming out of the ground, and that's there for a big vertical building that's been planned now for a long time.
Indeed, it is. Yeah, a confusing comment to have been made. So to recap just really quickly, what milestones would you like to see this government set to ensure that the Dunedin Hospital project stays on track?
Well, I'd like them to come back to where we were in April of 2023 and to do what Labor had committed to do, which is the total of 410 beds, that it does include 10 being built and shelved, and the 26 operating theatres, which includes 3 built and shelved, and everything else that was back in April 2023 had been agreed to.
Thank you so much for your time today, Rachel. It has been lovely. Again, that was Rachel Brooking, MP for Dunedin and Labour, speaking on Dr. Shane Retty's comments made towards the hospital rebuild. Keep it locked to the R1 News. We'll be back with Jonah's film segment in just a moment. But first up for you, this is Double Double and Trapjaw Kelpie with Nurse Joy. Let's get it. Kia ora, welcome back to Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. This is the R1 News at 1. I'm Jemima.
Kia ora, I'm Jonah.
And right now we have film review with Jonah coming up.
Yeah, so I didn't actually make the Dunedin Film Society screening last night, but sure, it was amazing, but I just decided to review one that was screened about a month ago called Burning. It's a 2018 South Korean sort of psychological drama film that really made a big impression on me, so I'd like to talk about it on the show today.
Cool, okay. Well, what's your take? What's it all about, and what did it impart on you?
Right, so Burning was basically a kind of a almost like a love triangle between a young, quite poor university graduate, a very wealthy man, and a also quite poor young woman who was a childhood friend of the poor man. And basically the thing that about it that really stuck with me was the way it kind of portrayed a very 21st century kind of capitalism that I think you see in a lot of Korean films. I think it's one of the reasons why South Korea is putting out such great movies at the moment, is because it really embodies the type of capitalism, the stage of capitalism that we're in at the moment, which is driven by kind of inequality, this kind of debt-driven consumerism that leaves people in tons of debt, digital alienation with us all on our phones, and all the kind of dysfunctions that happen in gender and society relations that come with it. And basically, long story short, it turns out the rich guy who's called Ben is a sociopath who likes to burn stuff down for fun. And Jong-soo, who is the poor guy, is trying to win back his the love interest, who's called Jaime. And that provokes a very disturbing and unfortunate series of events.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it's based on the short story Barn Burning, which is by Haruki Murakami, quite famous Japanese writer. And I think the film's definitely, if you read any Murakami, the film really encapsulates the mood that he kind of puts out in his writing. There's lots of jazz, really kind of hypnotic jazz score. There's lots of cats, kind of references to American literature, like Fitzgerald and the other guy whose name escapes me, but lots of American references to that kind of canon of American writers. And yeah, I just was completely engrossed for the whole screening and walked out quite shell-shocked, as you sometimes do with these types of things.
Fascinating. So this was for the Dunedin Film Society viewings a wee while back, but when are they? Just
so they happen,
remind our listeners.
Just to remind the listeners, the Dunedin Film Society screens every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. in Castle One at the university. It's probably the best deal in town in terms of movies. I think it's $40 for a whole year pass for weekly screenings. So, and it's just some of the most great classic and contemporary cinema at the moment. So, yeah, would recommend joining.
Get amongst. Cool. This wraps up our news show for today, Thursday the 19th of September. Apologies, listener. If you missed any of the show, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for R1 News. We had two interviews today with Juju Maharam from AYO, Amnesty Youth Otago, as well as the Honourable Rachel Brooking on the Dunedin Hospital rebuild and Dr. Shane Retty's comments. So you can find them online. We will leave you for today with Aidan Fine Gold. Keep it locked.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts. Or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
If every day you touch would turn to gold, would you save me from myself or let me go? 'Cause I'm on my
Thanks for choosing a Radio 191 FM podcast. There are more just like this at r1.co.nz.